It's my pleasure today to introduce Alex Filipenko. Alex is a professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley, is the winner of many awards. He was a Sloan Prize Fellow, is currently holding a Guggenheim, and received the Pierce Prize in the American Astronomical Society. In addition to what he's going to talk about today, which are studies of supernovae for cosmology, Alex also works on a number of different topics, including detecting and studying in great detail black holes within our galaxy, studying in the optical black holes that are million solar mass objects in distant galaxies, as well as something he might not talk too much about today, but maybe he will, which is properties of the supernovae themselves in terms of what they mean for us in terms of stellar evolution. Alex will be here the rest of the afternoon. I encourage people to talk to him after. We've sort of left the afternoon free for people to pick his brain. And I also asked him, or forewarned him, or told him that there were many string theorists in the crowd who might well want to know how hard they should really think about trying to get a cosmological constant. So with that, I'll turn it over to Alex.
Thank you very much, Lars. It's a particular pleasure to be back here, actually, because UCSB is my alma mater, my undergraduate alma mater, and so it's nice to be here and see Ray Sawyer and others from whom I learned almost on my mother's knee, but you know, so to speak. So, So Lars asked me to convince you or to show you whether you should take all this stuff seriously about the supposedly accelerating universe. So I'm going to gear this talk toward the physicist and string theorist who is not an astrophysicist. I will try to minimize the jargon that I use, the astronomical jargon. And the bottom line is that, you should be taking this pretty seriously. We don't know that the extra energy in the universe is necessarily the cosmological constant with a constant density, with an equation of state of minus one, the equation of state index. It may be some sort of a rolling scalar field, or who knows what it is, but there's some x component, omega sub x, which is definitely non-zero, and it's not 10 to the 120th power either, okay? But it's not zero, and there's a number of lines of evidence that are suggesting that now. So if you're in this field where it might make a difference and you're not taking this seriously, you're not in the race if you continue acting that way. And I hope to convince you. You gotta play ball at some point, all right? If you want to stay in the game. Yes.
What's your definition of X?
I'll talk about it. I'm just giving the bottom line because I know some people need to leave early and so on. And in particular now, the evidence has been growing for 3 years that the expansion of the universe is speeding up with time rather than slowing down, as everyone had expected. And I'll end my talk with the most recent evidence of a stellar nature using supernovae, and that is that we found a supernova at such a high redshift that we're seeing it from an era when the universe was still decelerating, when this X component, whatever it was, did not dominate over matter and over gravity. When gravity dominated, the universe used to be decelerating. And we think we've seen a glimpse of that era now, which, as I'll show you, suggests that our interpretation was right and that some sort of an astrophysical contaminant like dust or other things that I'll mention is probably not what's going on. And I'll talk about that near the end of my talk. And then, of course, there's all the evidence from the microwave background and other things, and you'll have someone else talk about that, I'm sure, if that hasn't already occurred. All right, so we all know that the universe is expanding. We've known that essentially since Hubble's seminal work in 1929. And here's a modern day plot of the distance of a galaxy versus its speed of recession, the redshift converted to an indicative speed. Of course, it's the universe that's expanding, not bullets zipping through a predefined space, but we'll just call it a speed anyway. And it's a very nice linear relationship, and you can see it going out to something like 2 billion light years in the plot that I've shown right here. And you might ask, how do we actually get these quantities? How do we get speeds of recession, and how do we get distances? Because this will be the error bars. Well, we don't know the distances of galaxies very well for reasons I'll tell you in a minute. Okay, we know their speeds of recession very well. There are some error bars down here which are smaller than the points, because at small distances, the Hubble expansion is small compared to peculiar motions induced by gravitational influence of one galaxy on another, and so you have to worry about that. But at large speeds, the expansion of the universe totally dominates, so you don't have to worry about peculiar motions. Anyway, we get radial velocities easily from the redshift of the spectrum, and we're just going to forget about galaxies like Andromeda, which are so nearby that they're moving towards us. Distances are a lot harder, and what I will use here, just as a definition, is a particular kind of a distance, what we call a luminosity distance. The luminosity distance, d sub l, of an object is defined to be that distance which satisfies the inverse square law. So you measure an apparent brightness of a star, ergs per second per square centimeter, and if you know its intrinsic power, its luminosity, in ergs per second, then d sub l is that distance which satisfies the inverse square law. Okay? When redshifts become big, there are many ways you can define distances, and they, you know, we'll just choose one. Okay, so how do we get then distances? Well, you measure the apparent brightness, that's relatively easy to do, and you have to know the intrinsic luminosity of the object, or be able to calibrate it somehow. The best thing, of course, would be to have a kind of an object which always has the exact same power. Every, you know, Fred, Gene, Harry, they all have the same power. And then once you've found a few nearby and calibrated their luminosity, if you're certain that the ones that are far away that have the same luminosity, then you're home free. But light bulbs aren't exactly the same. They have a variety of powers. And so in practice, astronomers try to choose objects which have a relatively small range of luminosity, and that luminosity correlates with some other observable parameter which can be used essentially to read the label on the light bulb. So to give you a familiar example, they're not all 100 watt light bulbs, but if we can read the label and see that this one's 103 and this one's 92.5, well, if we can make that correction, great. Then we've got a calibratable candle or a calibratable light bulb. And maybe it's not completely standard, but it's nearly standard. Okay, so that's the idea. You get luminosity distances by finding something that you can calibrate and measure its apparent brightness. All right, so now let's get into a little bit of very simple theory. The expansion history of the universe is basically determined in standard theory by the average matter and energy, normal energy density of the universe. And you compare that energy density with some critical value, which is easy to calculate. It's 3 times Hubble constant squared over 8 pi g. And if the universe has a density which exceeds that critical density, then, in a sense, the initial energy of the expansion wasn't enough to overcome the tendency of all matter to pull on all other matter, and the universe will come crashing back down on itself, like an apple thrown at less than the escape velocity. So you have a big bang and eventually a big crunch. Or I like to say big bang gnab gib, which is big bang backwards. Okay, so a dense universe has a big bang and a gnab gib. All right, a universe which is essentially launched at the escape velocity continues expanding forever, but more and more slowly until at t equals infinity the speed is zero. But you never really quite reach t equals infinity. So anyway, this is the medium density universe, and the familiar analogy, it's the apple launched at the escape velocity from Earth. That also corresponds to a geometrically, that is spatially, flat universe according to general relativity, whereas this kind of universe corresponds to a curvature 1, a hypersphere universe. Okay? If you have an empty universe, of course, then the apple never slows down, just keeps on going linearly with time. Well, we're here, so we don't think we're live in a completely empty universe, but we may live in a nearly empty universe. That's a possibility. Just because this room isn't empty doesn't mean the whole universe isn't. And in fact, through a large number of arguments, observational astronomers have pretty much settled on an omega of 0.3 for matter in the universe. Luminous matter, dark matter, any kind of gravitating matter, antimatter, you name it, all that adds up to 30% of this critical density. So according to the standard observations up until a few years ago, the universe is one of these kinds of universes that will expand forever easily It will decelerate, of course, forever, because you can't get rid of the gravity of all the stuff pulling on all the other stuff. But it'll expand forever, and in fact, it corresponds to a negative curvature, which is either an infinite universe or perhaps a torus, a four torus embedded in some multi-dimensional space. You know, who knows? But the standard textbooks suggest that it's an infinite universe, although I have a bit of a hard time with infinite universes. Well, that's standard stuff. What if, however, there is some other effect, like Einstein's cosmological constant, which he conjured up in 1917 in order to reconcile the fact that in general relativity, as in Newtonian gravity, the fundamental aspect of gravity is that it always pulls. And so the universe should be crashing down in on itself. Yet studies of stars at that time, galaxies were not yet known, fuzzy-wuzzies, people weren't really sure what they were. But anyway, there was no systematic trend noticeable that stars are crashing down on us, or that anything else is crashing down on us. And so many people believed in a static universe. And so he conceived this cosmological constant, mathematically fine in relativity, as you know, but sort of a fudge factor. There was no other reason for introducing it other than to have a static universe. All right? But the idea would be that this would lead to no net motion outwards or inwards. Of course, it's a mathematically unstable solution. If you perturb the universe from this point of stability, it will either rapidly collapse or expand. So it still remained, you know, kind of an ad hoc thing because it's a mathematically unstable solution, but that's what he proposed. He later renounced the cosmological constant as being the biggest blunder of his career, because about a decade later, Hubble discovered that expansion of the universe. The whole philosophical and physical motivation for the constant disappeared. The universe could have been born initially in an expanding state, and no forces are needed to keep it expanding, so let's just get rid of this thing. All right? But the idea of the cosmological constant itself is not such a bad idea. Indeed, those of us who believe in inflation are essentially believing in an early universe cosmological constant that made the universe expand by arbitrarily large factors in an arbitrarily small amount of time, pretty much. And it was dominated back then by a false vacuum energy or something with a negative pressure, all right, which causes an acceleration of the expansion. All right. So that was the idea. All right. So the early universe was dominated by such a thing, and then it turned off, so it's clearly not constant, whatever it is. But most cosmologists, up until a few years ago, preferred a universe that had omega sub matter of 1 and omega lambda 0 and the total to be 1, because inflation and other similar theories essentially drive you toward the critical density, because regardless of what geometry you start with, regardless of how scrunched up material is to begin with, after a factor of a Google expansion, you don't really care what your original shape was, you're flat locally. And that's tantamount to saying that omega is 1, and you might as well make that omega matter of 1. So that's what most theorists preferred. All right? So, if you have a non-zero amount of this stuff, even right now, then here is then another possibility, another alternative to the diagram that I just drew. In addition to the three curves I had in the previous diagram, there's now another curve where you have some component which is repulsive and relatively constant with time. It doesn't have to be exactly constant, but at least more constant than gravity is. So the idea is that when the universe was small and dense, the gravitational attraction of material dominated over this tendency of space to inflate. And so you had a decelerating universe. But as the box expanded, the gravitational effect decreased, the constant stuff stayed about the same, and so eventually the constant stuff began to dominate over the gravity, and the universe started accelerating. Well, we'll get to that just now. Maybe it's anthropic. Maybe not. Maybe string theorists will find a reason why it's just now. I'm an observer and I'm presenting the facts as I see them. You are the jury and you will evaluate whether we have proven our case beyond reasonable doubt. Okay? So, David says just now, well, I don't have an answer to that. Okay? All right. So how does an observer, such as myself, actually try to find out what world model we live in, which one actually applies to the universe? Well, here's how you do it. All right? You take a hint first from something I wrote here, and you say, all right, what you really want to do is trace the past history of the expansion And you can do that by looking at sufficiently distant objects and essentially look at how fast the universe was expanding long ago. And do that at a range of distances, and you will trace out these curves. Let me give you an example. I uncovered this a bit too early, but suppose you're looking at a galaxy at a redshift z of 1. What you're seeing are photons from that galaxy as it was when the universe's scale factor, its size, so to speak, was half of what it is now. So r of t naught versus r over r of t was 2, and so by advanced calculations familiar to many of you, 1 plus 1 is 2. All right, so that's a z of 1. And you can see that at a z of 1, depending on which of these universes you live in, objects at z of 1 will have different look-back times, and hence different luminosity distances, because a luminosity distance is essentially, you know, you're measuring how long it took a photon to reach you from there. So in a universe that is ultimately going to collapse, well, that's a universe that was also actually pretty small back then, and so the look-back time is small. And in the progressively more and more open universes, or at least less dense universes, not necessarily open, but you have bigger and bigger look-back times. So that's how you do this. You do it at a range of redshifts, and you begin to see a divergence of these curves from the same slope. And they all have the same slope here because I drew them that way. That's because Hubble's constant, the expansion rate right now, is whatever it is. Astronomers may not agree on the precise value yet, to 10 or 15%, but the value is whatever it is, and that's, you know, so you have to draw all the curves to have the same slope here. So you have all, they all have the same Hubble law nearby, and then they begin to diverge. The omega m greater than 1 universes were basically smaller at a given redshift than the omega m equals 1 or smaller values of omega 1. So you have progressively bigger luminosity distances, which are measured in funny units called magnitudes by astronomers, but forget about that. It's just proportional to the distance. You have bigger and bigger distances at a given z for these universes that have less and less matter in them. And the biggest distance overall for those universes which, in addition to having very little matter, have a positive omega lambda. So what you need to do is find something whose luminosity distance you can measure. That's very tough to do because normal stars aren't luminous enough to be seen at very large distances. Galaxies are luminous enough, but they evolve in ways that we don't understand yet. So we don't know what the luminosity of any particular galaxy is at a particular redshift. And different galaxies have different evolutionary histories. There are elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies. So galaxies are just not that great, even though they were an early cosmological probe. But a good one are supernovae, and in particular a type that I'll discuss in a minute, type 1a. A supernova, you can see, is very luminous. It has about a billion to 10 billion solar luminosities at its peak brilliance. It's comparable to the luminosity of all the normal stars in that galaxy. So here's like 10 billion stars, and the integrated brightness there is about the same as of that one single star that's blowing up. Here's another way to look at it. This galaxy and the supernova within it is 100 million light years away. Here's a star in our own Milky Way galaxy, which is 1,000 light years away. Comparably bright, but this one's at 1,000 and this one's at 100 million. So that's a factor of 10 to the 10 in luminosity. So you can see them at large redshifts. Moreover, observationally, they're very homogeneous. I'll show evidence of that in a minute. And I'll discuss why we expect very little evolution as a function of z. And even if there is some evolution, we think we can actually get an observational handle on it by looking at nearby supernovae. And I'll explain for that as well. I'll explain that as well. You can test for complications locally, unlike the case for evolution of galaxies. So what is a type 1a supernova? Well, without getting into huge details, this is just the flux versus wavelength. Type 1 exploding stars have no hydrogen. The 1As, in addition, then have this silicon line. And beyond that, you don't really need to know much. But they're pretty homogeneous in most cases. They're not all exactly alike, but they're pretty similar. Here are three spectra of different supernovae at the same stage of their development. And you can see these three notches, which are faithfully reproduced in the three objects. There are some differences. You can notice some differences in this part of the spectrum. We never said these things are perfectly identical. We just said they're similar. And moreover, at peak brightness, when you look at these guys at in galaxies of known distance, you empirically find that they're all about the same to within 40 or 50%. with some exceptions, but most of them are the same to within about 40 or 50% in peak luminosity. So that's pretty good. They're nearly standard. I'll show you a way in a few minutes of reading the light bulb on the label on the light bulb, to correct for the slight non-standardness that we do notice among them. Okay, why do we think theoretically they should be standard? What's the motivation for their being standard? Well, again, without getting into too many of the details, what we think is happening is that a white dwarf, a degenerate dwarf, reaches the Chandrasekhar limit either through accretion from a reasonably normal star or through the merging of two white dwarfs which spiral together as a result of emission of gravitational radiation. And when you reach this Chandra limit, you essentially have an instability because the carbon and oxygen nuclei start hitting each other, fusing, releasing energy, but this is a degenerate object, so its equation of state is essentially independent of temperature. The gas doesn't expand as a result of this influx of energy, it just sort of sits there. More and more nuclei hit each other and you get essentially a thermonuclear runaway. And what's produced is about 6/10 of a solar mass of nickel-56, basically 14 nuclei all squished together very quickly, 14 helium nuclei I meant to say, all squished together. And the energy release produced by that squishing together of the nuclei is what disrupts the white dwarfs and makes it blow up. But what makes it glow for several months thereafter is the radioactive decay of nickel-56 to cobalt and finally to stable iron. And that's what makes the supernova glow. And this should be a pretty standard scenario in most cases, because it's always the Chandra limit, probably, which is reached. And it may be a little bit dependent on the heavy element abundances in the white dwarf prior to the explosion, or maybe not. But these are things we can test for locally, because type 1a supernovae in local galaxies are seen to occur in regions with large abundances of heavy elements and in regions of small abundances of heavy elements. So you can look observationally whether there is a difference in their brightness. They're also seen to occur in relatively young stellar populations and in ancient stellar populations. And again, you can look to see whether there's any dependence on the age of the stars from which the supernova formed. So the kinds of things we think might affect supernova brightnesses or luminosities at high redshifts are ages of the stellar populations and are things like the heavy element abundances. Used to be smaller amounts of heavy elements back then than there are now. And things on average were younger back then than they are now. But we can test for those effects locally. And that's the strength of this technique. Okay, so we have to find a bunch of them locally and calibrate them and see if there's any dependence on environmental effects. So how do we do this? Well, we take pictures of lots of nearby galaxies and we look for arrows. And where there are arrows, there are supernovae. You can see 4 out of 4. By induction, it happens every time. All right. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that. We take multiple pictures of the same galaxy night after night, and eventually a supernova occurs, as do the arrows. And we have software that pick up those signs. We have a telescope that does this for us at night automatically. The Katzmann Automatic Imaging Telescope, on which I spent about a decade of my life, and it finally works, largely because of the software written by my postdoctoral associate, Weidong Li. We've really gotten going in the last few years. We're already up to 22 supernovae in 2001, and we actually spend a fair amount of our time on follow-up studies, as you'll see from the data. We could find more supernovae if our only goal was to find lots of them. But we did find the first one of the new millennium, regardless of your definition of the new millennium, 2000A and 2001A. Okay, so we find lots of them. And we follow up on them. Here's a whole bunch of light curves, brightness versus time, through different filters, blue, visual, red, and near infrared. These curves tell us something about the physics of the explosions. I won't go into that today because I'll run out of time. But you can see the typical quality of the data we get with a 0.8 meter telescope. At Lick Observatory. All right. Well, what we and others have found from studies of type 1As in nearby galaxies is that, first, they're not all the same, and we've known that for a while, but their differences correlate with other properties. In particular, the nearby supernovae, which are the most luminous ones, rise and decline more slowly than the nearby supernovae, which are of low luminosity. So, if you don't know the luminosity of a particular supernova, but you have calibrated this relationship using a set of supernovae of known distance, you can measure the light curve of your supernova of unknown luminosity and figure out what its luminosity at peak is, because you compare it with the sample that you've calibrated through other techniques. All right. So that's how we read the label on the light bulb. All right. Similarly, the colors, how red or how blue a supernova looks, depends on how much dust and gas is between us and the supernova extinguishing the light. So supernovae could appear faint because they're far away, but they could appear faint also because there's fog in the way. The fog also causes a reddening, and so we can figure that out as well. And we use a technique called the multicolor light curve shape method, developed by Adam Riess in his thesis at Harvard a few years ago, and independently done by Mario Amui. All right, well, you can see what this sort of thing does for us. Here is a Hubble diagram at the top, luminosity distance versus speed, where you assume that all the type 1As are perfectly standard and that there's no dust or gas along the way to any of them. Just assume they're all the same. You get a pretty good Hubble relationship, but with a fair amount of scatter, 50% or so scatter around that line. But it's clearly a linear relationship. But here are some objects that quite clearly fall off of it. This one, it turns out, is behind a sheet of dust, and it looks too far away for its redshift because we have improperly accounted for the reddening or the extinction. We have assumed that it looks faint simply because it's far away. But part of the reason it looks faint is because it is behind a screen of dust. Here's one that looks too far away for its redshift, not because it's behind a screen of dust, but rather because it's one of the 92-watt light bulbs. It's subluminous. It's not 100. And these guys look a bit closer than they should because they're 103-watt light bulbs. If you then turn these supernovae into our machine and crank the machinery, having established the correlation with an independent set of a dozen supernovae, here is the Hubble diagram that you get. The scatter goes down by a factor of 3, making each supernova a factor of 9 more useful, because it goes as the square of the dispersion. And more importantly, we have a much better handle on selection biases and the subtle sorts of observational things that might bite us in the side if we're only getting the most luminous ones or something like that, because they're the easiest to follow. So we don't throw out any supernovae that we don't like or anything like that. There's no bias here. We just, any type 1A that we find and for which the observational database is sufficiently good, we throw into this box, outcranks the corrected distance, and you can see that we now have a much, much nicer Hubble diagram. And the fact that the dispersion goes down by a factor of 3 convinces us that our technique works. Regardless of why the supernovae have slight differences in luminosity, and we'd like to understand that eventually, but right now, just empirically, this works.
How much do we know that there are no significantly different types of supernovae in the ancient
universe? Right, so how do we know that there aren't significantly different types of supernovae in the ancient universe? Well, again, what's different about the ancient universe is that stars were in general younger, and the amount of heavy elements was in general smaller. And we have galaxies like that, or parts of galaxies like that, here nearby at home. And there are other kinds of supernovae. There are core collapse supernovae and all sorts of crazy, or basically two types, this type and the core collapse type. But the core collapse type comes in many flavors. But they have very different observational signatures. Their spectra are different. Their light curves are also different. So you would have to postulate a supernova which basically looks like a type 1A in the early universe, mimics it in all its properties except its peak brightness, so that in the end the peak brightness is what's fooling us into thinking that they're too far away, as I'll show you. But we have a way to test against that, and that'll be the last part of my talk. Yeah, okay.
I was gonna ask, do you understand the residual?
Yeah, we do understand part of the residual. Parts of the residual are because there are still peculiar motions in the universe. Galaxy clusters are pulling on each other. We're falling into the Virgo cluster. Or more correctly, the Virgo cluster isn't moving away from us as fast as it would be if both we and the Virgo cluster were massless. It's observed to be going away at something like 1,100 kilometers per second. It would have been going away at something like 1,400 or 1,350 if we were all massless particles. So the Hubble relation gives the wrong distance, in a sense, for the Virgo cluster. All right.
And you can't correct for that?
Well, you can, but you need some sort of flow models. And in fact, I have people working on looking for type 1As in different directions so that we can determine the flow model. You see, we work backwards, actually. We use the supernovae to get accurate distances. Okay, so that's nearby. Now let's go to the cool stuff, the distance stuff. I, in this talk, am representing the high redshift or high Z supernova search team, about half of whose members are shown here in Aspen. We have a yearly meeting in different places. We're meeting in a couple of weeks, in fact. Our team leader is Brian Schmidt at the Australian National University. And many of the results that I'll be presenting at high redshifts in this talk were crunched through and first realized by my former postdoc, Adam Rees, who's now a tenure-track staff member at the Space Telescope Science Institute. But it was very exciting working in the office next door with them while all these results were coming to fruition. We look for the supernovae in batch mode. Basically, we take wide-angle cameras, in some cases covering the field of view of the full moon, which is pretty wide for astronomers, actually. The Hubble Deep Field of the Hubble Space Telescope is like a grain of sand held at arm's length. It's much smaller than the full moon. And in such an image, if you go deep enough, there are literally tens of thousands of galaxies. And even though supernovae occur only roughly once every century or every few centuries for type 1As per galaxy, if you have tens of thousands of galaxies in each image and you have many images per night, and if you have good enough search software, you will find a dozen or two dozen supernovae at high redshift on any given night. And so here you can see an image taken on April 4th, 1998, and then 4 weeks later. And this is a particularly easy one to notice. This one stands out easily. But when they're on top of the galaxy, then it's a bit harder to see, you know. But we can find them. All right, so we find them in batch mode. And we confirm them spectroscopically using a big light bucket like Keck. This spectrum just took 40 minutes to get. It's at a redshift of 0.3. That's fantastic. Not only can we tell it's a supernova, but it's the right kind. Here's the silicon line that tells us that it's a type 1A. And for the aficionados, this spectrum is actually good enough that we're able to read the luminosity label by looking at the relative strengths of different absorption lines. I didn't go into that, but it's a complementary method to using the light curve shape technique. You can actually use spectral features themselves to determine the luminosity of the supernova. And we find batches at a time. Here's 17, I guess 14 of which were found in the course of two nights, which were well planned ahead of time. We knew when those nights would occur. We have backup time at other telescopes. And so we can pretty much guarantee that we will find batches of high redshift supernovae. That means that we can apply for and get granted follow-up time at major observatories, including the Hubble Space Telescope, with which we will follow these supernovae on their rise and on their decline. So we can measure the peak brightness, the light curve shape, the colors through different filters and things like that. If, on the other hand, I were to say to a major observatory like Palomar or something, give me time on the 5-meter telescope because next week I'm going to find a really bright naked eye supernova, just to be a bit extreme, they would laugh at me because naked eye supernovae are pretty rare. But distant high redshift supernovae are common. There's one going off somewhere in the universe every 10 seconds. And no matter where you point out of the plane of our galaxy, you're going to find them if you have good enough software. So we have scheduled follow-up time on major telescopes like the Hubble. And the Hubble, of course, provides the best measurements, but it's not needed for every single supernova. So we basically measure these guys on the rise and on the decline. And here are a couple of light curves of supernovae through two different filters, blue wavelengths and visual wavelengths. So here are the discovery images and some of the ground-based follow-up. Caught it on the rise, and then the Hubble Space Telescope kicks in. You can see it has smaller error bars. Such small error bars are not really necessary for such a low redshift supernova. They become quite necessary at high redshifts. But they help even at, you know, lowish redshifts. I mean, the Hubble points are better than the ground-based points. So we can measure the peak brightness. As a quick aside, for those of you who doubt that the universe is expanding, not that anyone here doubts it, I think, but let me give you the cute sort of evidence for it. The light curves would have been expected to be much narrower if observed in a frame that's not moving relative to us. But they're stretched by a factor of 1 plus z in time, because we're basically seeing a moving clock. And the stretch factor is exactly 1 plus z. And that's exactly by how much these light curves appear to be stretched. if you're a devil's advocate and you say, well, what if something about high redshift supernovae physically makes them slower than the nearby ones? We have even better evidence then. If you take the spectra of these things, you notice that at low redshift, the spectrum changes quickly with time. So a given spectrum corresponds to a particular evolutionary state of an exploding star. If you now look at a high redshift supernova and get its spectrum at an observed time, let's say, of 3 weeks after explosion, and it's a redshift 0.5 supernova, the spectrum looks like that of a two-week-old supernova. In other words, 2 weeks times 1 plus 1.5 is 3. So you're seeing spectral evolution, which is consistent with time dilation. And you could then say, well, something at high redshift makes them spectrally evolve in that way as well. But come on, you know. In science, there's never any proof. But I would say this is pretty darn good evidence that the redshift is expansion and not tired light or some other effect where photons give up on their long journey from us to. All right. So here are the results from 3 years ago at high redshifts, where we, the High Z Supernova Search Team, published 16 supernovae, and another team, Sol Perlmutter's Supernova Cosmology Project, an independent group, published 42 with somewhat less precision per object. So the results actually ended up being about comparable. But we both got the same results exactly. And so here's the low redshift Hubble diagram. Here it is at high redshifts. And you're supposed to notice that these points lie slightly above the other two dashed lines. In particular, the Einstein-De-Sitter universe, the omega matter equals 1, lambda equals 0 universe, is greatly disfavored. Here are the residuals in distance or brightness in some astronomical way relative to this dotted curve here. And you can see the data points are way above the omega matter equals 1 curve. And they're even systematically above the favorite, or not the favorite theorist curve, here's the favorite theorist curve, but the curve toward which observational astronomers were being drawn as of, say, the mid-1990s, where people were focusing in on omega matter of around 0.3, lambda of 0. Any single supernova doesn't look like it's much above that, but on the whole, they are. And like I say, there are many more supernovae, as I'll show you in a few minutes. The errors are a combination of shot noise, photon noise, and systematic things, like how well can we subtract out the host galaxy light in which the supernova appeared, things like that. Okay. Those are 2 sigma error bars right there. Yeah. Okay. So any single point doesn't give you much confidence. But in total, they do, and the diagrams will get better and better. I'm just doing a historical progression here. This is mid-1998. So here's what we published in the omega matter, omega lambda plane. Here are the 1, 2, and 3 sigma, essentially confidence contours, for this combination, omega matter and omega lambda. Notice that these measurements are measurements of distances. The distance of a galaxy at a particular redshift depends on how much matter has been trying to pull it back during the course of the expansion of the universe, and how much whatever weird stuff there is has been trying to push it away. So it's a tug of war. The distance which a galaxy reaches depends on who wins. So in a sense, we are measuring omega matter minus omega lambda. We're measuring which one wins. That means that our uncertainties are huge in this direction, because this is the direction of constant omega matter minus omega lambda. We measure that quantity to be negative 0.4. Omega matter minus omega lambda is negative 0.4. We're pretty good in this direction, however. All right. So unless there's something terrible systematic going wrong, we're well away from the Einstein-De-Sitter universe. We do intersect the lambda equals 0 universe, admittedly, but the preferred solution is up here. So let's now move on, see whether the story gets better. It does. But based on those data, wary, or I should say weary, astronomers pondered an accelerating universe. Weary not so much from all the nights we spent taking the data, more so from the sleepless nights we spent worrying that we had added 2 and 2 and gotten 5. Science progresses often through mistakes, but not mistakes of an arithmetic nature like that, okay? The steady state theory is an excellent example of something that was good for cosmology. It's wrong, but it caused cosmologists to question their assumptions to question just how good was the evidence for a hot Big Bang, and so on. So that was a useful development in cosmology. Adding 2 and 2 and getting 5 would not be a useful development. But Saul's group was getting the same answer, and we decided to essentially announce simultaneously, but without really knowing what each other's answer was. We just knew that they had a weird answer, and they knew that we had a weird answer, and so everyone is kind of cagey for a little while. There's another way of going about this, and that is to look at the microwave background radiation. And I won't go into this in detail because I want to concentrate on supernovae. But you know that the microwave background fluctuations are an indication, in a sense, of structures in the early universe, back when it was 300,000 years old. And in ways which are quite independent of specific world models, you can kind of tell what the typical physical length would have been of density or temperature fluctuations in the early universe. And that's relatively model independent because most universes converge to pretty much the same initial conditions, at least at a time of 300,000 years. Now, if you know the physical scale of typical fluctuations and you measure their angular scale, you can see whether you're looking at a Euclidean space where light rays diverge according to straight lines on a sheet of paper, or whether you live in a positively curved universe, in which case they diverge more slowly and objects look bigger, or in a negatively curved universe, in which case the light rays diverge more quickly, and hence objects of a given physical length look smaller. And this is one of the centers, of course, Santa Barbara, of these kinds of studies. But again, going back to mid-1998, here was the set of measurements, something like 15 different experiments, each of which was measuring the power at a particular angular scale in the sky. This is the spherical harmonic decomposition where the observed angle that you see is about 180 degrees over L. So 1 degree is about 100, L of around 180. And there seems to be a peak here where that's the preferred angular size of fluctuations. But there was always this concern that, well, COBE measured things on 7 degree scales, and CAT measured things at L equals 700 scales, and all these different experiments might have some different systematic effects that lead to a false peak. So there was some concern about that. Nevertheless, we took the data for what they were worth back then, and here are the CMBR results as of mid-1998. And since they are measuring essentially the geometry of the universe, which is omega total, because that tells you the curvature of the universe, they are nicely constrained, well, not so much by these data, but in principle, they're nicely constrained perpendicular to a diagonal line like this. And you'll see this better in a few view graphs. But they're indicating, even back then, omega total of around 1, a little bit less than 1. Here's the omega total equals 1 line. They were indicating something less than 1, but with very big uncertainties. Putting the supernova results together with the CMBR in mid-1998, here's what we came up with. A result which falls pretty much smack on the omega total equals 1 line, with omega matter of around 0.3 and omega lambda of around 0.7. Yes, there's an intersection with the lambda equals 0 universe, but only about at the 3 sigma level, barring unknown systematic effects, and I'll get to that in a few minutes. The Einstein de Zitter universe is not looking like it's in very good shape here. And again, the other team had very similar results. So, if there's something going wrong, it's going wrong with the supernovae themselves or in the subtle analysis of the supernovae. It's not a coding error or something like that. And by the way, the equation of state is constrained by these data to have W minus 0.6 or more negative than that, where a cosmological constant, of course, is W of minus 1, because rho is independent of the scale factor then. So we can already rule out something like 1D cosmic strings, because that gives a W of minus 0.5, I mean minus 0.33. The other thing we can show you is that clusters of galaxies, as I've said, had been indicating for quite some time that omega matter is 0.3, and I urge you to ask Mark Davis or someone else to tell you about those sorts of cosmological measurements. And they are reasonably independent of lambda because you're measuring the motions of clusters induced by other clusters, or you're measuring the masses of clusters through their X-ray emission, or something like that. And those are very local effects. They don't really care what lambda is in the universe. But there you get a concordance. Well, since 1998, one more thing. With those parameters then, Hubble constant of 65, omega matter of 0.3 and omega lambda of 0.7, you can then calculate the age of the universe. And the most probable age is around 14 gigayears with an uncertainty of 2 or so. This includes uncertainties in the astronomical zero points, things like Cepheid variables and stuff, for those of you who care. And the oldest globular clusters at around this time were estimated to be about 13 billion years old. So for the first time in living memory, there was a concordance between stellar ages for the universe and expansion ages. And those of you who know, for a long time, globular clusters were thought to be considerably older than this, and the expansion age of the universe was thought to be considerably younger, because for an Einstein de Sitter universe, you only get 2/3 of the zero deceleration expansion age. And if that is 12, then 2/3 of that is 8, and things are just really bad. 8 billion year expansion age and 20 billion year globular cluster age. So, even back in 1998, some people, at least cosmologists, began to take this very seriously. And in early May, a meeting was hastily convened in Chicago where this missing energy, I don't like to call it that, just like missing mass is not missing mass, it's dark matter. But I don't like to call it dark energy either, because the public knows E equals mc squared. If there's any equation the public knows, it's E equals mc squared. So then they hear dark energy, that means dark matter. No. Dark matter is stuff that gravitates. Dark matter is this stuff that does something else, okay? But anyway, Mike Turner called it the funny energy in the univere. He's a very smart guy, but he doesn't know how to spell. Mike, I'm sure you'll be looking at this talk someday. I'm just joking. You do know how to spell, and that's the problem with having these recorded talks. You can't say anything about anyone who's not in the room anymore, you know. It was just a typo, or a write-o, or whatever you call it. Anyway, funny energy in the univere, and I'm sure you'll have theorists talk about it at some future date or in the past. I'm not going to talk about it, but the simplest example is lambda. But it's not necessarily the only example. And indeed, lambda has problems. You know, why do we live right now in the universe where the energy densities are comparable? Some sort of a tracker field or something is perhaps a better thing, except that no one has any real viable physical model for those yet. They just say, let it be. And so, you know, you remove one tooth fairy with another. Well, by the end of 98, Science magazine editors decided to call this the science breakthrough of the year, even though we told them we're not sure of the answer yet. And they said, that's okay, no one ever is within 1 year. But people had had 9 or 10 months to shoot this down, observationally and in terms of interpretation, and no one had definitively done so. And of course, Einstein looks surprised, because we've you know, resuscitated the concept of a cosmological constant, but not to make a static universe, rather to make an accelerating universe. So, history since 1998, what is happening now? Well, the boring part, which I'll just skim through, is that we now have more supernovae. And here we show our results, old ones plus the new ones, plus the Supernova Cosmology Project results. And again, now, that's a darn truckload of supernovae. Look at them all. They're all sitting around way up here, way above the Einstein de Sitter universe, and even significantly above the Omega Matter 0.3 lambda equals zero universe. Similarly, the microwave background people haven't been just sitting around. They've had stunning success, especially in the past year. Boomerang, Maxima, Toco, Daisy, all these things are just fantastic. Let me just show you the Boomerang Max. I'm sure you've seen them a million times here. But you can see, a Fourier transform by eye, that the typical fluctuations in this map are about twice the size of the full moon. Look at them. There they all are. It's just fantastic. My hats go off to you. So that was a year ago. With a single experiment, they measure the broad range of Angular scales, greatly decreasing the probability that some systematic effect is affecting some experiments and not others and causing a false peak. So here's the Boomerang map. All right, not the map, but the power spectrum. And you have this first peak nicely delineated at about a 1 degree Angular scale. And Maxima did the same thing. And lately, a month ago, of course, they announced even better results. But here's the view graph from as of a year ago. And you can see that their contours are now nice and tight in this direction, as opposed to those big blue things that I had before. Because they now, well, a year ago, they were measuring omega total to about plus or minus 0.1. Now it's even better than that. And so they're pretty much not sensitive to the difference between omega matter and omega lambda. They're sensitive to the sum. And the supernovae are sensitive to the difference. And the clusters are basically insensitive to omega lambda. And the amazing thing is that we all intersect in this now pretty much, for cosmologists, new standard universe of omega matter 0.3, omega something else of 0.7. What are the errors? Well, you can see them. These are, I think these curves here are the two sigma curves, I believe. Yeah, actually I didn't mark that here, but I believe these are the two sigma. Anyone from Boomerang here can confirm that? The Boomerang ellipse, is that a two sigma? Not sure. Anyway, it looks good. And here's their more recent result just from a few weeks ago. They're even beginning to see the second and third acoustic peaks. It's fantastic. Okay, so things are looking good, but we should be careful not to rest on our laurels. And each of the different groups, the microwave background groups, the supernova groups, the clusters groups, they all have to look at their own potential systematic errors. So let me just spend a few minutes on our potential systematic errors. What could be going wrong with the supernovae? Okay? Well, there are two obvious possibilities. Cosmic evolution of the supernovae. Suppose they were intrinsically fainter back then, and so they look faint, not because they're farther away than we expected, but rather because they're intrinsically fainter. Or what if there's dust or fog along the way, so that once again we've overestimated their distances, just as you do to an oncoming car at night if you don't take into account the Santa Barbara fog. Okay? Well, in previous talks when I had no new results to discuss, I would show you the many lines of evidence that are suggestive that there is no significant cosmic evolution of the 1As, and that are suggestive of there being no significant gray dust, which, you know, what is gray dust? It's big things like an apple whose cross-section is relatively the same regardless of the wavelength of the photon coming in. And so you get an extinction of the light, a diminution of the brightness without an accompanying reddening. That's, of course, not what galactic dust is like, or stuff in our atmosphere, but you could conceive of dust like this that could be messing us up. So we have various suggestive lines of evidence, but I want to tell more about the recent stuff, the smoking gun. The smoking gun is to look at supernovae at redshifts comparable to 1 or greater. Because here's the rub. If some astrophysical contaminant is causing redshift 0.5 supernovae to appear fainter than expected, dust or evolution or whatever, you would expect that that effect would keep growing with redshift. The white dwarfs become weirder and weirder at higher and higher redshift. Whatever is making them look faint at redshift 0.5, it's at least as strong or stronger in effect at redshift 1 and beyond. Similarly, dust. There's more and more of it. Not that there's necessarily a lot at redshift 1. It took time for the dust to appear. But the integrated amount along any line of sight will grow with redshift. You're not going to have a negative amount of dust suddenly, okay? So any systematic effect should cause the brightness of the supernovae at redshifts 1 and beyond to continue decreasing, all right? Something like this. And this depends on exactly what proportionality you use, okay? But here we've chosen one that's proportional to Z. On the other hand, if the cosmological constant, or something like it, is in place right now, then we expect the highest redshift supernovae to not be much dimmer and could even be brighter than the intermediate redshift supernovae. Why? Because at high redshift, we're looking so far back in time that the universe should have been decelerating. The rocket that caused the thing to go zooming up eventually a few billion years ago had not turned on yet, or at least was not dominating over gravity, because gravity back then was, in a sense, stronger. Not that big G was stronger, but things were closer to each other. All right? So gravity has been decreasing with time. The constant stuff has been staying the same. So if you look far enough back in time to a high enough redshift, you'll go back to a stage when gravity was dominating. Distances weren't growing very fast back then, and so the galaxies didn't have a chance to get that much farther away. Do you get the idea? All right. So we proposed some observations, and we've made them, and we're actually analyzing the data, and we'll soon submit a paper on this, with some objects at redshift 1. These are not real data points, these black ones. These were the proposed ones. This is where the data could have shown up, for example. All right. So we have 4 or 5 around redshift 1. And just to convince you that we can find and identify supernovae at redshift 1, here's one at redshift 1.2, which is a supernova and arguably even a type 1A. There are features here that are unmistakably type 1a supernova features. So we can find them, but they're hard to work on, and the spectrum is non-existent out here because at such redshifts, the optical spectrum is shifted to the infrared, and infrared detectors and the brightness of the sky preclude, at this time, measurements of really high redshift supernovae in the infrared. But we had a really serendipitous, fortunate event occur, and that is that a supernova was found in the Hubble Deep Field by Ron Gilliland and Mark Phillips. And Adam Riess, who's now at Space Telescope, dug around in the Hubble archives and found a whole bunch of data of that same area of the sky showing the supernova as it was fading. And these data were taken without the knowledge that the supernova was there, and they were taken for a completely different purpose. But of all the sky, even, you know, well, you might say, gosh, lots of people were pointing at the Hubble Deep Field, so it's not like every part of the sky is good as any other. But even the Hubble Deep Field is pretty big compared to the regions that happened to be followed up by several other astronomers for other purposes. And so Adam dug through all these data and found this supernova brightening and fading. It was discovered already when it was fading. But here it is. It's supernova 1997 FF. You actually can't tell that it's there except for the arrow. What you're seeing here is just the host galaxy. But it is there. And I'll show you subtractions of images taken without the supernova's presence and from images that had the supernova in it. And here in the near infrared, the subtraction shows a nice little image there. These big contours here are where bright galaxies were, and you can see that they've been subtracted quite well. The only thing that remains here is this little dot. And here's in the near infrared and somewhat farther into the infrared, and you can see this dot. You can see how close it is to the edge of the field that was imaged. And indeed, for those of you who like to pay attention to the observations, at infrared wavelengths, you have to dither the detector a little bit, because otherwise you get all these weird artifacts. And in 1/3 of the dithers, the supernova actually fell off of the detector. But in 2/3, it didn't fall off of it, fell on it. So we were just really, really lucky in many ways. So you look at the data points for this thing, and you don't know the redshift yet, so let's try to figure out the redshift. Let's take some guesses. Here are the data, and let's suppose that this were a supernova at redshift 1.3. Then you can ask the question, do we get a consistent-looking light curve? Well, if it was found by Gilliland and Phillips 7 days before peak brightness at a redshift 1.3, then the data don't look like a type 1a light curve. And here they don't really either, and here they don't really either, although it's a bit better. How about redshift 2, found at an early stage? Doesn't look good, doesn't look good, doesn't look good. Redshift 1.7, found 8 days after peak brightness. Hey, wow, it kind of looks like a 1a light curve. That's the first. Now, don't laugh. I mean, you can laugh if that's all there were, but that's not all there is, okay? So at least we've demonstrated consistency with a 1a light curve at a particular redshift and a particular age at the time of discovery, okay? Next step. Does the redshift of the host galaxy agree with 1.7? Well, it's a tough one to do. We don't have a very good spectrum of the galaxy yet, but here's sort of broadband photometry. Logarithm of flux here, sorry about that, versus sort of broadband brightness measurements in the ultraviolet, blue, visual, infrared, and so on. And galaxies consisting of composites of stars have some spectral energy distribution, SED. And you can calculate for different types of galaxies what their SED is, and in fact you can measure it using nearby galaxies, and then you can redshift it out to different redshifts and see what it would look like. And the only ones that are consistent with the measured points, these squares, are galaxies consisting of pretty old stellar populations, that is, galaxies consisting of already fairly old stars, at a redshift of 1.7 or thereabouts. So this looks like an elliptical galaxy, a galaxy whose stars formed long ago in a fairly spheroidal shape. It doesn't look like a starbursty spiral galaxy, and it certainly doesn't look like a nearby galaxy. So the so-called photometric redshift of this galaxy is 1.7. Well, that's kind of groovy, because that's exactly what the preferred supernova redshift was based on its light curve. And finally, an actual spectrum of the galaxy looks something like this. Here's the optical spectrum, And admittedly, it's very noisy, but this is a very, very faint galaxy, and we're using the Keck telescope, and so we're using the best that you can do, but it's just a hard measurement to make. Here's one of Hiron-Spinrad's high redshift galaxies with integrated colors, or a stellar population that kind of looks like that of this galaxy. So this is should be a good match to the spectrum. And this has now all been this is in the observed frame, and so these are rest frame wavelengths here. And those that can multiply quickly in your heads will figure out that this is all consistent with a redshift of around 1.7. Admittedly, we need to get better data, and I'm going out to Keck on Monday to get better data on this galaxy, hopefully to get the redshift more securely. A near-infrared spectrum is pretty noisy, but gives a very tentative oxygen 2 emission line, which is also consistent with a redshift of 1.7. So here we have three arguments suggesting that this object is at 1.7, all right? None of the arguments is airtight yet, but they're all pointing in the same direction toward the same numbers. And we have a light curve which is consistent with that of a type 1a supernova and inconsistent with type 2 and the other kinds that we know of. Now, it might be consistent with a kind of a supernova that we don't know of. Okay, fair enough. But it is consistent with a supernova that we know of, and we don't know of any nearby supernovae that have the same properties. So finally then, where does this object lie in the sort of residual distances plot versus redshift? Here it is right here, with generous error bars. We don't know the redshift. The brightness was tough to measure because this thing was near the edge of the frame and, you know, it's faint and all that. What does this arrow mean, reddening? Well, if there's some dust in the way, then the intrinsic brightness of the object is at least as bright as what we measured it to be. So it can only be systematically lower. Okay, so what is this telling us? Let's look at the different curves. First of all, and most importantly, this was what we were after, is this data point consistent with the hypothesis that the intermediate redshift supernovae were fainter than expected because of evolution or a dust screen or something else that's proportional to redshift? And you can see that it's many sigma off. The prediction was for a much, much fainter supernova at this redshift. So we're well away from the curve that had been postulated by Drell and company to explain these points. You saw the punchline, Ray, so see you later. Anyway, bye, Ray. Anyway, so it's inconsistent with this curve. Admittedly, it is consistent with the omega matter 0.35 lambda 0 curve. Yep, in fact, it falls nearly right smack on it. But that curve is inconsistent with the intermediate redshift points. And I just told you that those points are not faint because of some screen or evolution or whatever, because if that were the case, then the curve would be something like this, or at best becoming flat here and only marginally consistent with these data. It's also consistent with the omega matter equals 1 universe, lambda equals 0. But that curve, as we said before, is totally inconsistent with the intermediate redshift supernovae. The closest we can come to is the empty universe. No matter, no lambda, nothing. Well, fine. But again, the object is more consistent, and these intermediate redshift supernovae are more consistent with a curve that initially goes up and then comes down, rather than with a curve that is flat all the way through. In other words, the preferred model is still omega matter around a third, omega lambda, or x, or whatever it is, quintessence, k-essence, that's for you to decide. It's more consistent with that than with the other hypotheses. Now, it is only one supernova. Maybe it's intrinsically overluminous. Possibly. I don't deny that. But if it's overluminous in the same way that nearby ones are overluminous, then it should have had a broader light curve. And it didn't. It had a normal-looking light curve. Right? Maybe it was intrinsically overluminous for some other reason that's not correlated with the light curve. That's a possibility, okay? Maybe it's lensed. There are galaxies along the same line of sight, only a few arc seconds away. You can calculate the expected amount of lensing and the expected amplification of the brightness of the supernova, and it's maybe 20 or 30%. Okay? not a factor of 2 or something like that. And something that my observations will address on Monday is to measure the speed with which the stars are moving in the galaxies that might be lenses, because that tells us something about the mass of those galaxies and hence the total amount of lensing that might be occurring. Moreover, there's circumstantial evidence that there isn't much lensing occurring. Because if there were a factor of 2 brightening of this of an object that's intrinsically here, but it's being brightened up to here by some lensing effect, lensing not only brightens objects, but tends to produce a shear, a smearing of the galaxies that are being lensed as well. That is, the host galaxy of the supernova should be sheared in a tangential direction, all right, if there's that much lensing. And the galaxy looks round. Now, you could say, if it's, maybe it's a spindle-shaped galaxy, one of these really cigar-shaped ellipticals that happens to have an orientation radial between the lensing galaxy and the supernova. That would then take that flattened elliptical galaxy, tangential shearing would bloat it out into a circle, and it would look like a circular host galaxy. Yeah, that's all possible. But all these things are unlikely. And my point is that you'd have to compound several already fairly unlikely effects to produce the full deviation from this curve. Now you might say you don't need the full deviation. All you need is to put the 2 or 3 sigma contours coincident with this curve, or something. Maybe we've overestimated this curve. Maybe it actually only does something like this. After all, that's model dependent. How much evolution are you assuming? And admittedly, we're not that far past 3 sigma away from a plausible evolutionary curve. So we have not definitively proven acceleration in today's epoch and deceleration at redshift 1.7 with this one supernova alone. However, with one supernova, the results are about as good as could have been expected in support of the lambda 2/3 matter 1/3 hypothesis. And they do not support the alternative hypotheses of evolution or dusty screens or something like that. So we will try to measure more supernovae in the future, and certainly to see if the constant is a constant or changes with time. You have to measure the equation of state as a function of redshift and all that, W of Z. That will require either a satellite like SNAP or another survey that will find thousands of supernovae and will measure them with great precision. But this is a step in the right direction, and one that came which came sooner than expected. Because it's hard to find and plan follow-up observations of redshift 1.7 supernovae. This was a serendipitous set of observations where dozens and dozens and dozens of orbits of Hubble Space Telescope time went into a project that had nothing to do with this supernova, and there happened to be a supernova there. This suggests to us, of course, that if we're smart, we will coordinate our future activities so that they, at least in scientific goals of the data, coincide with what other people might want who are studying lensing or large-scale structure or whatever. If we design our observations so that the observations are useful for several different types of studies, we are all more likely to get the giant amounts of telescope time that these sorts of projects require. So I hope I've convinced you that we're along the way and that you should take Omega X, whatever it is, seriously. Thanks.
If you had plotted the error bars for this one at 1.7 the same way the errors were plotted for the other 6, what would they look like? Or just error bars instead of...
What we've done is sort of better than that, because we show confidence contours in that we admit an uncertainty in the redshift of around a tenth, and we admit uncertainty in the measurement of the brightness of the supernova. So we've kind of taken both together and made a whole contour out of it. But you can kind of see, if I just plotted it, if you want just error bars, they'd be, well, 1 sigma, they'd be about like that, and they extend farther.
2 sigma seems less than 2 times 1 sigma.
Well, 2 sigma is 95%, and 1 sigma is, 68%. So that's not my fault. That's just Gaussian statistics, So.
It's partly the fact that you plotted as a two-dimensional contour, not as a one-dimensional measurement. And that's why the flattening happens. And so, the visual impression is kind of probably unfair, actually.
unfair to...
Makes the error look, makes it look like the separation from the dust is bigger than it actually is.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I mean, why
didn't
you plot all those kinds of things?
Right, that's...
Oh, yeah, okay. That's a fair enough thing. Because for the other points, the uncertainty in redshift is zero, because we've measured precisely the redshifts of the host galaxies. So a two-dimensional aerial contour collapses to a one-dimensional error bar, you know?
Okay. So let me ask a question. So so we've discussed this plot a lot here. We all have decided to take severe exception.
Okay. Thank you. I came here to be grilled.
So
although Adam did most of the work. Okay.
So since now we know this is the omega total equals one
right.
curve.
So yeah.
There is an omega total equal, and this is John Rule, and actually John Rule has made the plot. Maybe showed you today. Mm-hmm. But showing evolution relative to this curve.
Yes.
You know, it's now we know artificial. If rather you showed evolution relative to omega total equals one curve,
yeah.
then basically there's no change in the evolution from here. The distance is the same as here. And so
I take some exception.
Right. So basically, if
so, yeah.
So whatever it was, it doesn't change
okay.
there.
I see your point. Okay. So it's not that you disagree that these points are far away from there, which is what I said long ago, that Einstein de Sitter is way off. It's that having now seen from the microwave background that omega total is 1,
yeah.
the relative normalization should now be to this curve. And indeed, this point is, in fact, remarkably the same lateral distance from this curve as those guys are from there. Point well taken.
So that
absolutely.
So I think very
good point. Very good point. Pardon?
You can respond. You need a lot of redshift one to do that.
That's right. You would. But point well taken. The lateral distance from this curve is the same as here, and so in a sense, this makes things look a little bit better than.
Well, is this your straw man? It just has too much straw, right?
Well, we're, you know, in this game where one match could set the whole field afire, you know. no, that's,
other
yeah,
questions?
No. Point well taken, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the equation of state, what is the latest?
Okay, so the equation of state, I didn't have time to talk about it all. We can say with something like 2 sigma confidence that W is less than minus 0.6. And with 1 sigma, we can say that it's less than about minus 0.7, 0.75. That's almost at the range where you can start ruling out two-dimensional topological defects and stuff. And it's certainly very consistent with W of minus 1. Okay? We have no knowledge yet of W of Z. Okay? So in other words, we have no redshift dependence at all yet. We're barely getting even a handle on W. But it's definitely not 0. For matter, and it's not 1/3 or anything like that for radiation. It's not negative 1/3 even for some weird remnants from the inflating universe or something. It's something more negative than that. Yeah, it turns out that going much beyond 1.7 doesn't really help you, because all the action is between now and 1.7. By the time you're at 1.7, the universe was really quite dense, and omega x, no matter what x is, wasn't having much of an effect. And this just gives me an excuse to show one more view graph, but you can ask, are we seeing this supernova in the epoch of deceleration? And if so, by how much? These blue points are the turnover, where the universe is going from decelerating to accelerating, okay? The way to read this is if omega m is 0.35 and lambda is 0.65, then that transition occurred at around redshift 0.7 or so. It's actually sooner than you thought, just a few billion years ago, maybe 5 billion years ago. Okay. All right. If omega matter is 0.15 and lambda is 0.85, then the coasting epoch occurred at around redshift 1.05. If omega lambda is around 0.9, then it was like here. And clearly our supernova is at 1.7 or 1.6 or bigger. So unless omega matter were bigger than 0.9, this supernova is in the decelerating era of the universe, and by a reasonably large factor. I mean, you know, taking our canonical thing of 0.65, boy, you know, this thing's at 1.7 and the turnover occurred at 0.7. So that's what that's really saying is that by the time you get to 1.2, 1.4, 1.5, most of the action is over, all right? Or hasn't begun yet, you know, if you go farther back in time. The universe was matter-dominated back then, and it doesn't really matter what the other stuff was. So if you look at, for example, the proposals to measure thousands of supernovae, they're going to pay their attention. They're going to sink their teeth into objects between redshifts of about 0.3 or 0.4 up to something like 1.4 and 1.5. And by measuring then the distribution of points back on this plot, we will be able to test models, which I'm sorry, I looked in the airplane, I just don't have my plot, but for the different quintessence and k-essence and other models that people are coming up with by Steinhardt and Albrecht and others, they predict what this residual brightness or distance, quote unquote, should be in different models of the universe. And, you know, some of them cross the empty universe line, and so you can't do this at just one redshift because, you know, at a single redshift, you could be consistent with several different models. But if you do this at a variety of redshifts, you can actually exclude some of the things that are being proposed now. And so this is really very exciting to be able to do this. Now, will it be possible with the satellite that was proposed? Well, it's not clear. Maybe some modifications will be needed. Or maybe it can be done in a complementary way with something like a big, deep survey of the sky, largely from the ground. That's another way of doing it. But something like this should be done in the next 10 years because supernovae are the best cosmological distance indicators that we have right now at large distances. So they offer the most precise and reliable measurements. And so this is the way to really see what the dominant component of the universe might be. And for those who are struggling with the existence of stuff out there, well, I view it as a glass being half full, not half empty. It's not that, oh, gee, this is inconsistent with string theory, and so we're just going to dismiss it. As I was told by one member, not of this particular group, because I don't see him here, but some years ago when I first presented this talk, it was like, you guys can't be right, because we have absolutely no conceivable explanation for how this can occur, so you're wasting big telescope time. And I said, this is going to be an observationally settled issue. And if the observations of supernovae and the microwave background, etc., keep on affirming this effect, then I have no doubt that someday in the future some young whippersnapper will think of a way that it is consistent with the theory of everything. And this now gives us, in today's low-energy universe, a way to throw out some of the competing hypotheses, I'm hoping. Now, I'm no string theorist, so maybe right now none of them admits this. But someday, some theory will. And those that
optimistic yeah. Note, yeah.
So there you go. Okay. Thank you. And I'll be around, you know, those of you who want to grill me some more. Okay, I came here, you know. So